So we turned the word weird into an acronym, which stands for Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic. And they turn out to be the weirdest people in the world. I can tell this group is very weird just from having just chatted with you outside. When you learn something, it actually changes your brain, so you're biologically different due to the learning process, the way it reshapes your neural circuitry. So we find differences around the world in memory, attention, visual perception, spatial reasoning, time psychology, and I just ran out of space on the slide. Much of what you read in psychology textbooks is the psychology of weird people of a particular population. And we need to understand the history of psychology and how our minds have changed in response to languages, technologies, and institutions.
Liebe AHA-Hörerinnen und Hörer, willkommen zur letzten Episode des letztjährigen Festivals. Aber bevor es losgeht mit der Lecture, die nächste Festivalausgabe steht vor der Tür. Am letzten Januarwochenende, also am 26. und 27. Januar, werden wieder rund 20 WissenschaftlerInnen und Experten viele Fragen beantworten, die euch interessieren. Etwa, was ist Liebe? Warum machen wir Musik? Lässt sich guter Fußball berechnen? Oder auch, wer hat Europa entdeckt? Das ganze Programm findet ihr in den Shownotes oder auf unserer Website und auch der Ticketlink ist da. Wir würden uns sehr, sehr freuen, wenn auch unsere Podcast-Hörer und Hörerinnen am Festival sind. So, und jetzt kommen wir zur Lecture. Die Stimme, die ihr anfangs gehört habt, gehört dem Anthropologen Joseph Henrich. Er ist Direktor und Professor des Instituts für Evolutionsbiologie der Harvard-Universität in Boston. Joseph Henrich veröffentlichte 2020 das Buch The Weirdest People in the World, das zwei Jahre später auf Deutsch unter diesen Titeln erschienen ist. Die seltsamsten Menschen der Welt, wie der Westen reichlich sonderbar und besonders reich wurde. Darin erklärt Henrich die unterschiedliche Entwicklung, die der Westen im Vergleich mit dem Rest der Welt erlebt hat. Seine überaus interessanten Erkenntnisse könnt ihr jetzt hören. Ich wünsche euch viel Spaß und hoffentlich bis bald am Festival in Luzern.
Well, hi everyone, great to be with you. Today I'm going to be drawing on my book, The Weirdest People in the World, and to tell you a little bit about psychological variation and some of our efforts to explain that psychological variation. And this is the shameless advertising part. You can see the book's available in many languages, popular European language as well as Asian languages. Now, I often get concerns that the book is rather thick. The German version looks like a tome you might want to keep a door shut with. But I'd like to point out that it's mostly footnotes and references, and there's lots of pictures. So it really shouldn't be scary. Okay. All right. So this is a backronym that two colleagues and I coined in 2010, and it became a New York Times Word of the Year. I'll tell you what it means in a second. But the journey to this begins when I'm an anthropology professor at Emory University in Atlanta. And by a strange quirk of fate, I got recruited to be a professor in psychology and economics at the University of British Columbia. And there I met two social psychologists, Steve Heine and Aaron Zion. And over a series of lunches, we were each talking about the stuff we were working on and about the variation we were finding across populations in different aspects of psychology and what economists call preferences. So I was working on things like risk-taking and temporal discounting, altruism, reciprocity, things like that. And Ara was working on analytic versus holistic thinking, so how people target a problem. I'll say more about that in a minute. And Steve Heine was working on the self, how people think about themselves across societies. And not only were we each finding that there was substantial variation around the world in different populations, more than psychologists and economists had previously indicated, but the populations most commonly studied by these disciplines turned out to be unusual, psychologically peculiar. So by 2006, we had the title. We knew we were going to call it The Weirdest People in the World. But as I began to write the draft, I was calling them American undergrads because 70% of all psychology students had been American undergrads at this point. And that wasn't working rhetorically, so we turned the word weird into an acronym, which stands for Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic. And they turn out to be the weirdest people in the world. I can tell this group is very weird just from having just chatted with you outside. Okay, now at the time we did this, 96% of all students in psychology came from weird societies. So 70% American, then Canadians, Australians, Brits, and then some non-English speaking Europeans as well. By the time the book came out, that we, you know, we made a big hubbub, we wrote this big paper, there was, you know, a lot of back and forth. It's down to 95% now. So we haven't really moved the needle a lot, but people recognize the problem. Almost no one says, don't worry about that, it's actually fine. Okay, just to give you a brief look at the kinds of psychological traits I'm talking about, I'm going to say more about these, so if you don't recognize these terms, that's okay, you're going to hear more. Individualism, analytic thinking, a non-relational morality, a dispositional orientation in how we think about people, trust in strangers, and intention-based morality. Now, often the reaction I get is many people, including many psychologists, have a digital computer metaphor of the brain, of the mind, that somehow there's hardware, which is what maybe cognitive scientists and neuroscientists study, and then there's software, and that's given to the anthropologists and maybe the social psychologists. Well, it turns out that's not really how it works. And when you learn something, it actually changes your brain, so you're biologically different due to the learning process, the way it reshapes your neural circuitry. So we find differences around the world in memory, attention, visual perception, spatial reasoning, time psychology, and I just ran out of space on the slide. So there's a lot of the things that cognitive scientists study that they think are like, you know, the random access memory part of our brain. It doesn't really work like that. Okay, and the last point, which my clicker is failing me. Don't set up a weird, non-weird dichotomy in your mind. There was something I didn't realize when we first coined the term weird, was it invited people to look at the opposite. I say, look, there's these weird people. They say, oh, everybody else is non-weird. But just to give you a quick analogy, it's kind of like I'm telling you about goats, and then you say, oh, there's non-goats. And knowing that someone is a non-goat, whales and snakes are not very similar, so it doesn't really tell you much about the category. Okay, come on, clicker. Okay, so to warm you up, I want you to try to answer this three times. This is called the 20 statements test, and it's given by social psychologists, and it's been done with people around the world. So I am, and then fill in the blank. Maybe you're describing yourself to another person. Okay. So I might answer this. I am Jessica's father. I am a brother. I am Ara's friend. Although that's probably not how I would have done it. I would probably have said, I am curious, I am a scientist, I am a sea kayaker. And the axis that psychologists have found is some populations tend to talk about their attributes, aspirations, and accomplishments. Things that make me special, that set me apart, that part of what I want to communicate to you about what makes me different and special, versus roles and relationships. So you do this among some populations, you get 80, 90% roles and relationships. If you do it among American undergrads, you can't find a role or relationship. It's basically all about how they're curious, intelligent, you know, this and that. So this is part of a complex that psychologists call the individualism complex. And anthropologists have been on to this for a long time. So the famous Princeton anthropologist Clifford Geertz described it like this early on. The Western conception of the person as a bounded, unique, and more or less integrated motivational and cognitive universe is, however incorrigible it may seem to us, a rather peculiar idea within the context of the world's cultures. So within this complex, there's a focus on the self, on those attributes and accomplishments, on, you know, a narcissistic focus, an atomic view of the self, so the self as a differentiated piece of the world, not necessarily connected to others. An emphasis on guilt versus shame. So anthropologists have long noticed that some societies are shame-oriented and others are guilt-oriented. If you're guilt-oriented, it means you are trying to live up to your own standards that may or may not reflect societal standards. So where I live, you know, I might think that I should go to the gym on a particular day and not do it, and then I feel guilty about that. But my neighbor is not judging me. My brother's not getting a bad reputation because I failed to go to the gym on a particular day. It just works differently than shame, which if you violate a shame thing, then, you know, your brother could get a bad reputation. People will think badly of you, that kind of thing. And overconfidence. More individualistic populations tend to be more overconfident, meaning they actually make misjudgments of how good they are at something. And self-enhancement, it's when you put your best foot forward and try to emphasize your positive traits rather than telling things about yourself that make you seem less interesting. Okay, so if we map the globe, and this is based on older data, but the same basic patterns apply, and this is country-level data. Now, soon I'm going to throw out the country-level data and dig in and actually compare Europeans living in the same country, but we'll get to that soon. Just at a country level, the most individual populations in the world might not surprise you. My countrymen, along with the Australians and the Brits, although, you know, you can see Europe's pretty dark there, Switzerland's pretty dark. And then it's important, I want to emphasize the gray, because we're still really at the beginning of mapping global psychological variation. So when you see all the gray in Africa and Central Asia, it's because we don't have the data. Okay. All right, now does this kind of psychological stuff matter? Maybe this is just people answering questionnaires. So this is from a paper in economics, and I'm going to circle back to innovation. But these economists tried hard to knock out this correlation by adding all kinds of other things that might explain it, things like wealth and things like that. And what you find is that more individualistic populations produce more innovations per person. So their output of patents, and you can use different measures of innovation and you get the same answer. So that's just an interesting thing to say, look, this matters for things economists care about as well. Okay. We don't really know how big the iceberg of psychological variation is around the world, which is why I put a picture of an iceberg here. But just to give you some sense, one of the most interesting and non-intuitive areas, I think, for the folks in this room will be the use of intentions in moral judgment. So if I were to give you scenarios where in one case someone stole something on purpose, and in another case they took it by accident without realizing it wasn't theirs, maybe it was hidden in a bag or something, you'd probably make a big difference in how you would judge and penalize that person. Well, we did a whole bunch of work around the world, and we find that Westerners are at the extreme, and then some societies don't take intentions into account at all. And if you look at the history of Western law, you can actually see the increasing importance of intentions in making judgments over time in Western law. So it fits with the psychological changes that I think is going on. Analytic versus holistic thinking. So analytic thinkers tend to think in straight lines. They make unilineal continuums. They break problems down into its parts and assign properties to those parts. So physicists give us particles with properties, charge, spin, gravity, things like that. Psychologists give us personalities. Economists give us preferences. So they're all breaking things down into parts and assigning properties. Holistic thinking is thinking about relationships. How do two things interact? Non-relational morality is universalistic morality versus a non-relational or parochial morality. It's how much you think that the law, the rule should apply to everyone versus it's morally more correct to be better or nicer to people who are closer to you. So nepotism, is nepotism good or bad, would be part of that. Dispositional thinking. So this is this idea that individuals can be defined by properties that cut across contexts. So if I say you're honest, that implies you're honest in lots of different contexts. But of course, it turns out people can be quite honest in one context and not so honest in another context. So that's dispositional thinking, and that varies. Some societies don't do much dispositional thinking at all. They expect people to vary across these contexts. Now, if you're taking a psychology course, you might have heard of the fundamental attribution error, which is this tendency to make dispositional attributions. So if someone doesn't come to work, maybe it's because they're lazy, or maybe it's because they had a flat tire, or their kid needed to be taken to daycare, something like that. And cognitive dissonance. So Westerners, weird people, like to be consistent across contexts. Not everybody cares about that, it turns out. And I point these last two out just because they're textbook material, right? So this is presented as human psychology within psychology. Trust in strangers varies a lot. Conformity, using famous psychological experiments from the 1950s. Patience varies around the world. And that's just, I ran out of a slide again. Okay. So one kind of cautionary note I want to make is, I've noticed a lot that people want to valence these some of the attributes I'm using here. And I think conformity is a good one, because where I grew up, if you called someone a conformist, you were saying something bad about them. I'm definitely not doing that, and I think more importantly, the inclination is a kind of ethnocentric inclination. Because it turns out that the populations that are conformist actually think it's good to be a conformist. And if you say, what should you teach your children, they'll say, we should teach them to be conformist. And if you show them videos of a kid either being a conformist or non-conformist and saying which kid is smarter, people in some places will say the conformist is smarter, And people in the U.S., at least that's where the data is from, will say the nonconformist is probably smarter. So this, the idea is going to be throughout the talk that our aspects of our psychology are adapting to the institutional worlds that people confront. So they're adapted to different kinds of institutional worlds and roles. Okay. All right. So the first question I want to address is, how can we explain the psychological variation around the world? And just to show you a little more variation, this is the difference in people have for out-groups, people they don't know or haven't met before, versus trust for their in-groups. So family, friends, neighbors, things like that. And there's just a lot of variation in the strength of that difference and how much there is between your family versus a more distant stranger. So another important piece. And then do these cultural psychological differences influence things like the functioning of democratic institutions, financial markets, innovations, things like that. So this is variation in universal versus relational morality. Okay, so now to approach this, I'm actually drawing on my 2016 book. So I'm in the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard. And what I do is I apply the logic of natural selection, taking seriously the idea that we're an ape, to think about human nature. But I'm particularly interested in our cultural learning abilities, how we learn from others, and our ability to learn motivations and heuristics and emotions from other people. And one of the things that this process of learning from each other, where humans transmit ideas across generations, it gives rise to cultural products. So here I put complex tools, practices and rituals, social norms and institutions, and languages. So then our minds have to develop both over ontogeny as we grow up and then over generations as people adapt and modify their child rearing and socialization practices to alter our psychology. So we know, for example, whether we see certain illusions depends on the visual world in which you grow up. So your brain modifies itself so it can see better, and then it changes your visual processing. Societies that don't have books don't have myopia. So that's something where your visual system changes. Self-regulation varies based on ritual practices. Pro-social motivations vary a lot. Our ability to deal with numbers. So many societies count 1, 2, 3 many. But if you grow up in a world where you can count without bounds, then you develop numerical competencies that you wouldn't have otherwise. And spatial cognition varies. I won't go more into that. Okay, now this leads to non-genetic differences across populations because we're adapting to these different technologies and institutions. So you don't want to create a kind of dualistic world where, you know, it's biology on one side and culture on the other. We are a cultural species. We are evolved to to adapt to the world ontogenetically, so non-genetically, to the institutions and languages we have to navigate. But I am also interested in the longer-term process, and that's what my other book, my 2016 book, is about, the process taking place over hundreds of thousands of years. Okay, so we're going to be focusing on norms and institutions, and in fact, we're going to go to the most fundamental and the most primordial of human institutions, our kinship or our family organizations. And I mentioned the importance of human nature. Well, one thing we know about human nature that we share with other apes is that we're biased towards those who we're genetically related to. People call this kin psychology, but we see it in chimpanzees and other species. But cultural evolution has extended this out into our social networks. So lots of societies, for example, call certain cousins brother and sister, but not other cousins. And so that changes the nature of the relationship. But it's harnessing our kin psychology. Almost all societies, with just a couple of exceptions, have a marriage system, and this is built on pair bonding, which we also share with gorillas. So gorillas are pair bonders, but marriage provides a bunch of norms, connects the child to the male side of the family, creates affines, does all these cultural things. We also have incest aversion to avoid inbreeding with close relatives, so that's that disgust feeling if I tell you to imagine sex with your sibling. But that can be extended to create taboos against cousins and stepmothers and things like that. All right. And the nature of the way in which culture has reorganized these kind of evolved anchors of our psychology really alters the social structures in the world people grow up into. Okay, now at the core of, or one of the cores of the theory I'm going to lay out is that something happened to European families at some point beginning in late antiquity in the early Middle Ages. They became small monogamous nuclear families. And this called forth a bunch of other institutions as well as psychological changes of the kind we're going to talk about. Just to give you a sense, in case you're not anthropologically informed, of just how peculiar European families are. So this is from an anthropological database called the Ethnographic Atlas, and it's a list of 5 common kinship traits. And the percentage is the frequency in this global database of anthropologically known societies. So bilateral descent, that's the descent system you're all familiar with. It's when you trace the child's relations through both mom and dad. So you have, you know, you're related through mom and dad. Over half of societies, only 28% of societies have a system like that. The rest of them do patrilineal descent or matrilineal descent or something more complicated. Little or no cousin marriage. So you can see that 75% of societies have cousin marriage and some encourage it. It's unusual not to have cousin marriage. Monogamous marriage, very rare. Only 15% of societies in this database prevent high-status elite males from taking additional wives. Nuclear families, even rarer, so only 92%. Only 8% have nuclear families, the rest have some other formation. And then neolocal residence, sorry for the fancy anthropological terms. Neolocal residence is when the bride and the groom set up residence independent of either of their two families, so they set up a new location. That's exceedingly rare, so 95% of societies don't do that. Now, if we add all those up, we can see that over half of all societies have zero of these traits. Very few have all 5. They're either European descent societies or they're societies that were Christianized early. So one of the societies in that very thin bar is Cebu in the Philippines. And it happens to be where Magellan landed. And Magellan, Antonio Pigfetta, who is Magellan's chronicler, talks about all this polygyny and cousin marriage and stuff. And on cue, Magellan started railing against the polygyny. He died in the Philippines, but I don't know it's because of that. All right, so this is an important institution historically because it's probably the oldest of all human institutions, and it's also the first institutions that we encounter when we grow up and when we enter the world. Okay, so now with that as a little bit of background, I'm going to be trying to explain the origins and variation in this pattern of weird psychology. And by the end, I'm going to try to make some connections with innovation, although in the book, I make these other connections as well. Now, one of the key drivers here is going to be this change in the family structure, kinship and family organization. And that change is going to give rise to some of the other features of European history. So by the High Middle Ages, you have guilds, which are basically self-help organizations that take the place of some of the family, what families do in lots of societies. Monasteries proliferate, charter towns proliferate, where people join as individuals and become members, a voluntary organization. And then universities, there's the Bologna model and the Paris model, and they begin proliferating. These institutions compete, they have to offer better deals, because individuals can change these groups, not like they can change clans or families or things. This leads to urbanization, occupational choice, and the spread of impersonal markets. So you might remember from history class, the commercial revolution begins in Europe in around 900. And then urbanization begins rising. Europe's only about 1% urbanized in the year 800. So that's the Carolingian Empire. And then it passes China by 1200 and passes the Mediterranean and Middle East sometime after 1500 in terms of urbanization. Okay. Now, the key story I want to go to now is why did the family organization change? Okay. And I'm going to argue that it was one particular branch of Christianity developed a set of prohibitions and prescriptions about marriage and the family and implemented this systematically over centuries. Okay, and I'm going to try to provide evidence for those 3 bars. So just to give you a sense of how this works psychologically, because we have an institution and these rules of kinship that create the family. So how does that affect how we think? So we have intensive kin-based institutions where that's where the social norms are building a tight network that people have to navigate. And the other is this world of monogamous nuclear families where you don't have much kinship at all. And so in that world, in the intensive kinship world, most of your relationships are given at birth. Whereas in the mobile world, I mean, you got mom, dad, and a few siblings, and everything else you have to find and find your own relationships. In the intensive world, you've got to conform to all these roles and expectations. In the other world, you've got to cultivate these unique attributes to go out and find all those relationships you weren't given at birth. In the intensive world, you have to seek new connections based on who you already have connections to. So trust in this world depends on having a lot of connections to a person, whereas trust in the other world is dispositional. People are trustworthy, honest, they have these traits that you look for. Intelligent. So that's that. The intensive world is a world of shame, where you have to live up to other standards. But the mobile family world cultivates a sense of guilt because you need to have these, your own rules in order to cultivate these attributes that are going to set you apart from others and allow you to find these partners. In the intensive world, your identity is based on your relationships versus in the other world, you're cultivating this unique self. So you can see some of the patterns that we're thinking about. Now, many people think that the European family shifted when wealth began to rise. So wealth doesn't begin rising until after 1800. So that would mean the change in the European family occurred relatively late. There's broad agreement that that's definitely not the case. So the real transformation in European families was in place in many places before 1500. So here I'm drawing on work by Jack Goody, but other historians have now chimed in, and you know there's new data coming in all the time on this from ancient DNA. So beginning in late antiquity, the church began to adopt a series of these prohibitions and prescriptions about the family. Probably the most famous one are the extension of the incest taboo. First, the church tabooed first cousins, then second cousins, eventually all the way out to six cousins. And then in the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215, it was brought back to just cover up to third cousins. So this, when you go out to six cousins, it's basically anyone who you could possibly be related to. And there's still a relic of this in many marriage ceremonies. So if you've been to a Christian wedding, there's often a moment at which the priest or preacher says something like, "If anyone can show just cause while this couple cannot be lawfully joined in holy matrimony, let them speak now or forever hold their peace." And then there's a pause. Everybody looks around. That's actually was introduced during the Carolingian Empire. And it was a part of an incest inquest because it was going to say, okay, we've got everybody who could possibly know anything. Are we positive they're not related? And then if nobody says anything, okay, they're not related, marry them. Okay. So that's just still a relic. Of course, the church also banned polygamy, also, unlike the Roman Empire, banned sex slaves, tried to end arranged marriage. Most people don't realize that. But in the Christian ceremony, the bride gets to say, "I do." That's like her last check, like, you do, right? You really want to? And that's for the woman, because normally nobody asks the woman what she wants. And then, I mean, traditionally in other places. The church also encouraged ending corporate, they wanted inheritance to come down the lineal line, and because they didn't want like uncles and other relatives getting a hold of the land, because they wanted people to be able to give the land to the church on their deathbed. So, which a lot of people did. The church got rich by death bequests. And if the inheritance systems had been like other societies and hadn't been transformed, the church couldn't have done that. Okay, so there was a monetary incentive. Okay. So that's the history, but now, you know, I'm a scientist, right? I need like something that looks like real data. So this is a paper we published in Science that's proving that it's actual science. And so we got data on medieval church, on this diffusion of the medieval church, and I'll tell you more about where this data comes from in a second. We also got data from around the world on cousin marriage, and then data on psychology from around the world. Okay. So my task is going to be to show that there's a relationship here, a relationship here, and I ought to be able to do that if that's in fact the case. Okay, so the first one is centuries under the medieval church of these different populations. So now these are countries, and you can see that the more time a population was underneath the church, the lower the rate of cousin marriage. I could also show you other measures of kinship. We have this thing called a kinship intensity index, which takes all five of those measures that I mentioned into a single index, and the relationship looks very similar. The same thing around the world is we found 17 different measures of psychology that were available for lots of countries around the world. So I could show you all 17 of them, but what's amazing is they all tell the same story, which is the story in this picture here. That the higher the rate of cousin, or the higher the rate of cousin marriage in a country, the less individualism and what we call impersonal psychology. So that includes things like cooperation and trust with strangers. So more cousin marriage, less trust in strangers, less individualism, less analytic thinking, those kinds of things. And then finally, this one, more centuries under the medieval church, more of the individualist impersonal psychology. And importantly here, whenever we could, we ran it for the spread of the Eastern church. And we always get this kind of light relationship where it's often a real non-zero relationship. So more centuries under the Eastern church, higher in this psychological domain. And it's always weaker than the Western church, which fits with the history because the Eastern church adopted some of the practices that the Western church hid, but was often unenthusiastic about enforcement. All right. Okay. Now I want to zero in on Europe, and this will give you a sense of how we constructed at least some of these measures. So what we did is we made a database of the diffusion of bishoprics across Europe. So we have a GPS location for every bishopric and a date. And then what we say is that once that bishopric arrives, that little section of Europe is under the influence of the Roman Catholic Church. And you can see it. So this is changing through time. There's 650, 750. Now, if the dots go gray, it means that that chunk of land is under a political power unfriendly to the bishop in Rome, so unfriendly to the Pope. And you'll see that that is going to be important for understanding places like Sardinia and southern Spain and other places. Okay, yeah, you can see there's the Italian boot. Okay, so this gives us dosages as we look around Europe, and we're going to analyze this map. The blue is the Carolingian Empire, and we think that's important just because the Carolingian emperors teamed up with the Pope, and they were very much, they loved this idea of imposing this. They probably loved the idea because it weakened aristocratic families that they were battling with, and they got to kind of tear apart their alliances because they couldn't marry each other. But nevertheless, the Carolingians were interested in imposing it. We also put the Iron Curtain on there because that may be relevant. Okay, then we went to the European Social Survey, and we got measures of individualism, independence. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through, but it's questions like the one you see up here. Measure of conformity and obedience, measure of impersonal fairness, and what people consider the famous trust question. So generally speaking, would you say that most people here can be trusted, or that you can't be too careful in dealing with people? And people answer on a 1 to 10 scale. So we get that for a couple hundred thousand people in different parts of Europe, and we can assign a church exposure measure to the 442 different regions of Europe. And then what we do is we only compare Europeans with other Europeans living in the same country. So we hold the country constant. So there's nothing about national health care or any of that kind of stuff. We're holding the country constant. And what we find is that people from places, Europeans from places that had more time under the church, more centuries of church exposure, show greater trust, greater impersonal fairness, less conformity and obedience, and greater individualism independence. Now, the sort of standard model that a lot of people have is everything's about income and wealth. So we hold that constant. That's usually not an important predictor of much. We hold income and education. Well, I'm sorry, income and education, we hold that constant, as well as sex and age. We hold geography constant. We have a whole bunch of geography variables. Climate. You might worry that it was about Roman influence. So we have the map of Roman roads, and we can look at proximity to Roman roads and see if that's important. We try to account for early prosperity, so the prosperity in 500, number of other controls in there. Perhaps the analysis that I found most persuasive is when we threw out Western Europe and we just analyzed Eastern Europe, we get the same relationship when we look at just the eastern side of the Iron Curtain. All right. Now, I could also show you evidence that the Western Church powerfully predicts rates in Europe of cousin marriage in the 20th century. For that, we had to go to requests for dispensations, because the church figured out a way to monetize the fact that people really wanted to marry their cousins. So at first, they just banned it. But then later, I guess they thought, and then they started charging people for it. And you know, you can get the kings and queens and stuff to pay you for it. And so they monetized it. So we can look at requests for dispensation. And so that's related. But this stuff is perhaps more fun. So the prevalence of cousin marriage in the 20th century in different parts of Europe, and we only have data for Italy, Spain, France, and Turkey, but more cousin marriage, less individualism and independence, more cousin marriage, less impersonal fairness, more cousin marriage, greater conformity and obedience, and less impersonal trust. So the same basic pattern fits. Mostly it fits within countries. We only have 68 data points, so sometimes it doesn't always fit, but generally follows the patterns. Okay, so that's just variation within different parts of Europe. Okay, now this is a fun one. So we take out of the European Social Survey just the second generation immigrants. So these are people from all around the world who have migrated to Europe. They had children. The children grew up entirely in Europe, went to European schools, speak the language perfectly, all that sort of stuff. And then what we do is we assign them to a kinship intensity measure from where their parents came from, either from the country or from the ethnic group. So we have analyses, which I'll mention in a moment, where we compare immigrants from the same country but who come from different ethnic groups in the same country. And we can also do it with cousin marriage. And we find the same basic pattern, which is that comparing only immigrants, the second generation immigrants, living in the same European country, when they came from a place that had higher kinship intensity, they showed less impersonal trust. Or the way I wrote it on here, when they come from a place with lower kinship intensity or lower cousin marriage, they show greater impersonal trust, greater impersonal fairness, less conformity and obedience, and greater independence and individualism. All right? We can hold the income and education constant again. We even hold feelings of being discriminated against constant in the analysis, geography, climate, and then I mentioned some of the other fancy stuff where we compare people whose parents were from the same originating country but different ethnic groups. All right, so that tells the same basic story. Now, historians love to criticize me. I don't think they like all the math and everything. And they tell these complicated stories about elites having disagreements and stuff. So the way I want to reply to the historians is saying, okay, we went lots of other places in the world. We tested the theory in different places. So Augustine Bergeron went to the Democratic Republic of Congo, and he looked at where the ancestral Christian missions were placed, and then he looked at the village where people came from. And then he's able to show that people who were from villages who were closer to historical Christian missions had lower kinship intensity and had greater moral universalism and less in-group loyalty. So you find the same basic pattern when you transport and look only at people in the DRC based on the placement of historical Christian missions, which arrived around 1900 and are no longer there in the modern world. So these aren't existing things anymore. This is a historical legacy. Another thing I do in the book was lots of things affect this kinship tightness intensity that I was talking about. So I think the church played a big role, but lots of ecological factors also matter. Famously, and anthropologists have been talking about this for a long time, paddy rice agriculture seems to really pull together clans, and it leads to a lot of strong clans, probably because of the labor demands and the nature of the labor demands. So we looked at China and India, which both have paddy rice. In China, it's a north-south gradient, and in India, it's an east-west gradient. I'm anticipating the concern because lots of things could vary north-south in China, but you'd have to have a story where it varied east-west in India and north-south in China. We find that rice gradient, that reliance on wheat versus rice, predicts the kinship intensity measured with clan data, its clan lineages, and then that's associated with analytic thinking, in-group loyalty, and self-concept. So we can transport, and this is only, when we do it in China, we only do it with Han Chinese. So it's comparing Han Chinese to Han Chinese in different provinces. And then we can look at the historical U.S. So European populations moved to remote parts of the U.S. in different states, initially small populations. Protestantism got rid of the bans on cousin marriage, so people started marrying their cousins. Different states implement bans on cousin marriage at different times. And we don't have the psychological data, but we can see when the states implement the bans, there's a decline in the amount of cousin marriage in those populations, and then they have greater urbanization movement and greater income moving forward compared to other Americans when the bans came in later. Okay. All right. So I mentioned that I would try to link some of this psychology to things economists care about. And so now I want to talk a little bit about innovation. So this relates to the book I'm working on right now. So many different psychologists, I'm thinking of the work of Harold Gardner here, philosophers like Paul Fagar, historians of technology, all point to this idea that inventions, whether they're scientific ideas or the steam engine, are actually recombinations of ideas from from existing ideas. So this suggests that what invention might be is the recombination of diverse ideas. If that's true, you can build some simple mathematical models to show that the larger populations, more cognitively diverse populations, and more interconnected populations will produce more recombinations, and that'll lead to greater innovation. And there's a variety of lines of evidence I could point to, but I want to apply this to the case of innovation in Europe. And in the book, I want to address the industrial and scientific revolutions that appear. So scientific revolution, people argue about it, but sometime around 1650, scientific revolution seems to take off. Newton publishes the Principia, 1688, 1690. And then, of course, the steam engine, 1712. And then things really blast off around 1750. So there's a bunch of things going on that are consistent with the collective brain. I mentioned rising urbanization. There's a lot of internal movement within Europe. The nature of institutions had changed, too. So in most societies, apprentices, if you're trying to learn a skilled trade, are related to the master. But in Europe, we began to see strangers becoming apprentices, and this grew. And then there was the new journeyman phase, where you had to leave the master's office and go to another master, and there would be other journeymen coming in from other places. And that's a really ripe situation for recombination and the exchange of ideas. So we see that emerge, plus a bunch of knowledge-based institutions like universities, knowledge societies, like the Royal Society begins in the second half of the 17th century, coffee house culture and whatnot, literacy. And then in order to make that really function, you need trust in strangers, nonconformity, willingness to do things different, break with tradition, and a tolerance for differences. Now, this graph here I plotted here, this is just to give you a sense, to give some kind of numerical picture of how the collective brain is growing in Europe. So there's our timeline. And what I did is I took the population of every European city over time and the cost that it took to move between every European city. So I took an individual and I said, let's assume they can talk to everybody in their city or town. Okay, now to add that, let's look at every other town, but divide by the cost, basically, you know, kind of moderate it down by the cost. And so that's what it looks like. And the qualitative picture is what's important, is that you have this dramatic increase because of growing urbanization and reduced transportation costs. You're more interconnected to other populations. Okay. All right. Now I want to bring it right down to the modern world. So this is a plot of the rate of patenting, of patents, in contemporary Europe. So the darker areas produce more patents. And this is for all these little tiny areas of Europe. This is with my two economist collaborators. Okay, this is, patents here are a proxy for innovation. So I'm going back to this measure. So this is my measure of church exposure, so number of centuries under the church. And I can use that to explain weird psychology. So I've been showing you some of that stuff. So the church affected the psychological variation. This map, the darker it is, the weirder the psychology. This area is very weird here. And other places too. This is the patents. So there's our weird psychology. But if we look at percentage of nuclear families or having Facebook friends far away, right? So the idea is, well, I don't have a lot of local contacts, so I'm going to make friends by advertising all my attributes. And so I get more faraway Facebook friends. And here's a map of the nuclear families. The map looks similar for the Facebook friends. And I can explain that with the church data. So I can make this link for you. And then finally, I can do this link. So both of these together do a nice job of predicting important variation in patents. And then, of course, I can go like that. So diffusion of the church affects the contemporary pattern of patenting. All right, and so this just gives you a rough look at this. So more church exposure, more patents per capita. So it's as if the people in those areas are getting more creative, right? Because it's per capita, so they're producing more for every individual. Now, I'm running out of time, I'm sure. We did some fancy stuff. So we have a database of creative individuals, and we can look at whether it includes creative individuals and includes politicians and generals. So what we did is we looked at when the bishopric arrived in a different part of Europe, and we analyzed it to see if there was an increase in the number of creatives relative to the number of politicians and generals. Let's call those non-creatives. And what you see is that when the bishopric arrives, you might think, well, the bishopric will start enforcing conformity. No, actually, you get more creatives. You get more artists and writers and things like that, and you don't get more of the generals and politicians. So that's one fun event analysis that anchors us in history. It shows it actually affecting things as it occurs. The other thing we do is we have this medieval church measure, but we also have the records of the attendance at these synods that the church had when it talked about incest regulation. So we can see if your bishop showed up at the meeting. And, you know, we basically give you a point if your bishop shows up, and if he doesn't show up, then you don't get a point. We don't expect you to get as much of it. And we find that that adds to our predictive capability here. So more church exposure leads to more patents, but then if we include whether your bishop went to the meeting, then we get even more patents if he went to the meeting. And so that anchors it specifically to the incest legislation. Importantly, the meetings included a lot of things besides the incest legislation. Because, I mean, I'm anticipating my critics, right? My critics will say, but, you know, it wasn't random who went to what meeting, but they would have been going for other reasons. So we can talk about that later. Okay, so that's this. Oh, and then finally, one last fancy analysis is, I mentioned that the Carolingian Empire was probably important. So we use the patent data, and we have a map of the border of the Carolingian Empire, and we analyze how the patents change at, you know, this border from 800 years ago. And when you get to the Carolingian border, the patents go down in the modern world. Okay, so closing points. So institutions in psychology co-evolve. Much of what you read in psychology textbooks is the psychology of weird people, of a particular population. And we need to understand the history of psychology and how our minds have changed in response to languages, technologies, and institutions. And I mentioned a few things. I've talked about innovation, but similar things apply to law, religion, and democracy. So one of the things I try to do in the book is, you know, Max Weber famously talked about the importance of Protestantism. But, and I took as one of my challenges in the book, well, how did you ever get such a religion like Protestantism that's so individual-centered and so based on mental states, right? By faith alone. It looks very unlike other religions you've seen throughout history. You need some explanation of how you ever got to Protestantism in the first place. A point I just made is that deep history still shapes our world. So these things that go way back into time. Of course, lots of other stuff does too. This is not any sort of monocausal explanation. And then finally, I think it's sometimes missed that this is really a theory of change, right? This is about how populations have changed dramatically over the centuries in ways contingent upon whether a particular bishopric got set up in a particular place or not. So it's very much about a dynamic process. There's no way to essentialize groups or create any kind of, you know, racial type groups out of this. So, all right, that's everything.
Danke, dass du diese Podcast-Episode gehört hast. Ich hoffe, sie hat dir gefallen und du konntest etwas Neues erfahren und lernen. Und wenn du schon mal da bist, lass uns doch eine Bewertung oder ein paar Sternchen da. Das würde uns sehr helfen. Und wenn du mehr Vorträge vom AHA-Festival hören willst, abonniere diesen Podcast und folge uns auf Instagram und Facebook. Auch über Feedback freuen wir uns sehr. Schreib uns eine Mail an am@aha-festival.ch. AHA, ein Podcast für Wissen, ist eine Zusammenarbeit von Christoph Fellmann und mir, Anna Matijašević. Mitproduziert und komponiert hat Nikola Miloš Mišić.